that wonderful day, quiz day. Your fun of the week. Okay, so hopefully, well, let's see. Are any of these people here? Joseph Hazel, are you here? Okay. Bradley Lewis, are you here? Bradley Lewis. Goodness. Amber Mercer, way back there. Ethan Morgan, are you here? Okay. Bradley Lewis, no, whoever you, Amber? Okay, Ethan Morgan, Stewie Pullman, P-U-L-L-I-A-M, are you here? Isn't you? What's the first name?
Stevie.
Okay. Joffrey Smith. Ethan Morgan, you're here? Not here? Smith. And Bradley Lewis, not here. All right. Okay, as you can see, some people aren't here. Maybe they'll come for the quiz. But we do have some people that are out today too, sick. So that you know what that means. Just tell them the quiz was horrible and it covered everything, and that's the way it goes. Okay. So is that Bradley Lewis or Ethan Morgan back there? No? Okay. All right. Good deal. All right. So hopefully you've watched the echo recording from Tuesday when they canceled school. Came in and recorded. We covered a lot of material on that, which is testable for next week, right? Where are you going to take your test next week? In the lab, under your normal time, your normal lab period, okay? Come on time, so you have the time. It's not meant to last 3 hours, but you're given the time to relax and, you know, kind of think about things. When you get open response questions, what do you want to do? Read the question, underline certain things. Make an outline on your paper that you're going to get, a lot of blank paper, right? Make an outline, and then maybe start to answer it, right? And then go back to the question, make sure you crossed out everything that was asked, right? Because there's some of these questions that have multiple parts to it, so you want to not miss something, okay? And you got lots of time for it, but there's a lot of writing. So how are you going to study for something like open response questions? To write them out, right? And do diagrams. Guarantee you there's going to be a question on synaptic transmission, quantum hypothesis. There's a question for you right there, so study that point. That's probably a six-point question. There you go. Oh, we started with 6 points. How about that? So, you know, go through the synaptic transmission, quantum hypothesis. It's really important, right? The main things that we've covered. But we're really covering everything from the first day of class, hint, hint, first day of class, to the end of today, basically, right? Okay, so do study for that. All right, so beautiful crayfish picture up there. Wonderful. So we covered some of the aspects on the proprioception on the back of a crayfish as a model. Remember the MRO, muscle receptor organ. If you've watched the echo from Tuesday, then you'll know what I'm talking about. In case you don't know what I'm talking about, emphasized again, right here, this is that crayfish stretch receptor that we were mentioning. And then I went into the muscle spindle of mammals. And so if you're not familiar with that, you know, maybe you want to look that back up. Even on Wikipedia would be good, you know, just to get some, refresh your memory on things. Okay, on proprioception, muscle spindles, and there's that crayfish prep that we went over on Tuesday on the echo recorded, and then some pictures we went over in that class as well. There's your muscle spindle and your muscle, right? And how that functions in relation to the MRO. That used to be a standard open response question on past old exams, so hint, hint. Okay, and therefore we just love crayfish. All right, so we have some games today. Not games, but, you know, things to do. I need a victim, a volunteer. Volunteer victim. Oops, I'm a victim. I need your elbow, though, and your triceps. All right, and we can do it up here because the echo thing can record in case people are at home sick and playing around. All right, so what we're going to do to this poor guy, can you use this arm?
Yep.
And we're gonna vibrate right here. Have you all ever done this before in high school? No? You haven't ever played Pinocchio Nose in high school? Your teacher's deprived y'all. Okay, so what we're gonna do with this gentleman is he's gonna stand here. He's going to touch his nose And he's going to do something else on top of that. He's going to close his eyes. He's not going to cheat you. Watch. Make sure he doesn't open his eyes. And then he's going to slowly take his arm out and slowly bring it back while I'm pushing this thing right here in on his tricep, vibrating it. And then he's going to tell us as he's coming back with his eyes closed when he thinks he's going to touch his nose, okay? This is really fun, especially with elementary school kids. I usually use like a back massager, but the thing broke. And then I had one in the lab with this thing, but the it was all dirty with chemicals on it, so I got a clean one for you. Whoops, oh my God, that thing came up. Okay.
Where'd that thing go?
It's still rolling. Maybe the other one, the dirty one, was better because it didn't come off like that. All right, let's see if we can keep this on. I have to push on your arm to make it work, okay?
Yeah.
Let's see if this works.
All right, you may go.
Yeah, no, oh, yeah, touch. Shoot. Okay, where'd that thing go to now?
Where is it?
Oh, there it is. So you have to start with your hand on your nose.
Okay.
Goodness. Let's see if we can keep that thing going somehow.
You may do it.
This one.
Oh, this one?
Yeah, okay. And I'm going to try to keep that thing vibrate. All right, slowly take it out. All the way. All the way out. And now slowly bring it back and say when you're going to touch your nose, when you think you're about to touch. Right there?
About right here, yeah.
Okay, now open your eyes.
Okay.
So you get the idea. This is why we call it Pinocchio nose. You think your nose is actually longer than it really is.
Yeah.
If you ever do this activity with elementary school kids and middle school kids, the ones wearing glasses you're pretty safe with, but the ones without glasses, you have to watch out. They'll be going for their eye, so you got to put your hand in front of them, or they touch the forehead, or the way out here, and you think you're touching your nose. So what's happening here? Nobody's ever done this in high school? Oh, so deprived. Okay. So we are vibrating this muscle right here. And if you remember on Tuesday, we talked about the muscle spindle. The muscle spindle that's in your muscles gives you proprioception. It tells you where your limb is in relation to your body. So we're vibrating that muscle spindle and you can't tell what's happening. We're giving some false senses to it, hyperactivating it, and you can't tell where your arm is. So what does that tell you? Your joints, where your arms and legs are in respect to your body, it's not from joint receptors. I mean, think about it. Somebody gets a knee replacement, and, you know, the next day, they're told to PT, which is called physical torture. But PT is up there, actually, and they tell them to get up and start walking right away, right? Or hip. And they know where their leg is. They don't have any problem with proprioception. It might be painful, but they don't know what's going on, right? I mean, they're able to move. So people used to think it was all the joint receptors. It's not the joint receptors. It's your muscles. It's these muscle spindles that we just went over. And that same kind of analogy with the MRO preparation, okay? So we just did that. There are people that lost proprioception. There's some good YouTube links. I'll send you this one YouTube link of this guy in England where he lost his proprioception. The tract was damaged in his spinal cord, I think. And then he can't walk. He doesn't know where his limbs are. He doesn't know where his legs are. So he can't move. It's wild, right? But what did they do? If he looks at his legs, he can walk just fine. So he's using vision for his proprioception. So this is the whole idea of this chapter, sensory perception, okay? So we can use another perception for that proprioception. There are people that have, if you have a cancer, let's say you have bone cancer in your leg and it's painful all the time. If you know the tracks for pain up your spinal cord and the way that if you take a neuroanatomy course, it's really a good class to take, the tracks run right next to your proprioception tracks. So what people have done in some cases, instead of taking medications that affect your whole body for like cancer and pain, modulation instead of being on OxyContin and staying in bed the whole time, not being able to function, they can go in and actually reduce that pain by cutting some of the pain tracks. The problem was when they were first doing that kind of work, they actually cut maybe a bit too much and they could lose their proprioception too because the tracks are right next to each other. So they actually have people that are in surgery rooms with a neurosurgeon, some grad students, this was going on at Toronto actually, University of Toronto grad students that were in the physiology department looking at asking this person, can you move your leg? Can you feel your leg? Do you know where it is? And they're going through and saying, oh yeah, the pain stopped. But, you know, and they maybe will stimulate a little bit. Yes, that's, I feel my leg, you know, like it's moving, but it's not moving because they're stimulating it with electrical current. And so then they know not to cut anymore. So it's really cool, right? Lots of things that you can work together and actually work out sensory systems. So this thing's still going. Okay. So that was a demonstration of the Pinocchio nose. You get the idea, proprioception. Muscles that are active give you that proprioception. And so that's really quite neat because you have proprioceptors that tell you where your limb is, static. This is what we went over on Tuesday. And then you know dynamic, how it's moving, the rate of movement, all from those muscle spindles that are in there. Okay, just like the crayfish MRO. Okay, so we left off, so there you are, crayfish. We left off talking about receptive fields on Tuesday. So another victim, I need another victim. Yes, another victim, one of the victims. Victims, come, here we go. So I need your hand and your upper arm. And anybody ever do two-point discrimination before?
Oh, we did this in 425.
We did this in 425. Anybody have my class? Can we use your upper arm too? So she's going to put her hand here, maybe upside down. And thank you. And we joke around with people usually on this. That's pretty good. So maybe you can turn so the class can see you kind of. So what we're going to do is, have you ever done this in school? No? Still more deprived students. Okay. So two-point discrimination, if you do this in middle schools or other schools, don't use pointed toothpicks because the boys, there's a gender difference. They like to stab really hard and try to draw blood. But so you use the blunted toothpicks. Okay, so what she's going to do is she's going to close her eyes and she's going to say two or one. And I'm going to move these two toothpicks at different distances. So two or one, and your eyes are closed, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Two.
Two. And I'm going to go, and then she's going to say two or one.
Two.
Two. And make sure?
One.
One. Okay. And now I'm going to go up here on the upper arm, and she's going to say two or one.
Two.
Two or one.
One.
You see the difference? So, okay, that was great. Thank you. Fan of white. There we go. Okay. So you get the idea about receptive fields. The fingertips are very sensitive, and the upper arm is not that sensitive. And, oh, yeah, we told that joke in 440. 420, we won't go there now. Okay. She'll tell you later. You can go on the back of your back between your shoulder blades. That's where you're least sensitive. So why is it that you're so sensitive on your fingertips to two-point discrimination? Because, here's the take-home of this, the receptive fields are small. So small receptive fields, so like a circle. Think about those two circles close together and overlapping. Okay, so if they're close together and they overlap and you put two stimuli in there, you over two receptive fields. So you detect the two points. The receptive fields on your upper arm or between your shoulder blades are large and they overlap too, but they're more likely to get two within the same receptive field. So you got big receptive fields, some overlap, but you can get the two in the same receptive field, so you think of it as one stimuli. Now, there's some misconceptions in here too. I don't want to confuse you. You have like five different types of sensory receptors in your skin and your dermis, so you have to do light touch. If you push really hard, then you're activating some other receptors and you can pick up the two, okay? So just light touch, that's why we did light touch on your arm. Okay, but it works pretty well. So there's a two-point discrimination, so the take-home here is receptive fields. Why is that you feel that so well? That same receptive field goes up to your spinal cord and you have lots of neurons for that skin area, and then that projects to your brain as well. So on your brain, as we'll see later on, you have a map of your body on your sensory cortex, on your brain. So you've probably seen that before, a homunculus, and you have a large representation of your fingertips and your face. You're very sensitive to your face as well.
So I have a question. I just want to make sure I have this right. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
The reason why you're doing the one tip is because both receptive fields are overlapping. It's where they are overlapping, where you're only going to feel one.
No, they might overlap, but if you're in the two overlapping fields, then you're going to feel it as two.
Yeah.
But since if I do a drawing here on my arm, then if I was just in that receptive field, that one, then you only feel it as one, even though there's two. Okay?
I see what you're saying.
Okay, good. And so receptive fields are for everything, your visual field, other things too. So it's really quite cool. Usually we kind of did this in the lab, but the labs are kind of difficult to do. Anybody a good smeller? Anybody smell really good? Think they're high, good smelling? Not you, yourself, but can smell really well. No? All right, we got an activity for you. Somebody. Any victims over here? Victims? Guys? Girls? Girl? Victim. Oh, we got a victim. Okay, Maria, yay. Okay, so these are hot tamales. I used them just in class the other day, our 447 class. Anybody? Somebody's in there, 447, right? Yeah. Sensory biology class. So it's basically a new thing. So they used to have Red Hots a long time ago. They're really good. They kind of got wimpy these days. Now these are hot tamales. But when you go to public schools and you do something like this, anybody ever does a taste test? No one ever does it? More deprivation. Okay, so I found out by accident, you have to ask if anybody's allergic to cinnamon. Never dawned on me, but people are allergic to cinnamon. And one kid, oof. The parent wasn't happy either. But anyways, so what we're going to do, you're not allergic to cinnamon, right?
I'm not.
Oh, good.
Is it spicy?
No, it's not spicy. They're wimpy these days. They cut out the cinnamon. There's still the red dye for cancer, but that's okay. So what you're going to do, and I'll do it with you, okay? All right, so I'll do one too, just to show you I didn't poison them or anything. Take them off the ground. So don't put it in your mouth yet. There's two, okay? So what you do at the school is you support your local dentist because these things pull out your fillings. You have to close your nose. Then you put this in your mouth.
Do what?
Oh, to go for it. Or whatever you want. You chew it up a little bit, all right? At your tasting, all right? So you can taste it, kind of. And then you open up your nose and breathe in. Does it taste any different?
Yeah.
Okay. Tastes gross, doesn't it? All right, thorough. Okay. What's the point here? That thing is horrible. The point here is that when she opened up her nose, she could taste it better. So, what happens when you have a head cold? How does your food taste? Like English food, bland. All right, no spices. So what you actually find out is that about 80% of what you think you taste, you really smell. So if you like cooking and you want people to taste your food really well, what do you use? Volatile spices, because that way you actually smell it, right? So about 80% of what you think you taste, you really smell. And we have some really good sensory biologists on campus. If you know Tim McClintock, that's over in the physiology department, he studies smell. He used to work on lobsters a long time ago, actually, in smell, and now he's working on humans and doing affymetric chips on people that have different abilities to smell. What happens when COVID happened? People lost their sense of smell and taste, right? And it went both ways. It wasn't just taste, it was also smell. And then what happens with Alzheimer's when you get older? You actually can lose some of your taste abilities too, and smell. So they actually test these things because some of the sensory things are individual cue. Now, we already tortured you, but we'll just torture some other people. Vanilla. Can you smell vanilla? Okay. Is that okay? You smell it? You smell it? Okay. You smell it? So when you go to schools and you do this vanilla thing, you find out which kids can't really smell vanilla very well, and they'll say, oh, I can't really smell that. And then you can say, we'll take this home to your mom and dad and find out which one can't smell it very well, because one of them probably can't smell it very well, genetic differences. If both of them smell it, then you might want to see if the mailman can smell it or something. All right. So anyways, that's another sensory modality about smell, okay? So there are links to that. So that's kind of interesting as well. And if we look at other sensors, what's the other sense? What are the five senses?
Or six.
Yes, question.
I was just going to ask, you know why some people taste cilantro and it's like soapy and it doesn't taste?
It tastes gross, I know. Super gross. I don't know why. But some people don't like cilantro. So that might be interesting. There's probably some papers out there. Just do PubMed and look at it. They probably got a genetic link to everything. It's amazing what they got going. Okay, hearing. You've probably seen these little things. So let's see the senses. What kind of senses do we have to the external environment?
Sight,
hearing,
taste,
sight, touch,
smell,
sixth sense, can read your mind. Right, okay. So you saw Tuesday's lecture. Right, very good. So hearing, these are really fun to do too if you're in middle schools. And then you can hear these kind of things, and you can, you know, put that up to someone's ear, right? And they close their eye, and they can hear it. And then if you have the same distance behind them, you can find out that they can hear better in the front of them than the back. And is it okay if we put this in the back of your bone? And if you put it right, oops, sorry. And if you put that right back there, do you feel the vibration?
Yeah.
Yeah, you can feel the vibration. So this is why if you record yourself, anybody ever, you know, talk and record yourself, you sound different? It's because you're vibrating the bones in there, and what you hear is different than what you project for other people to hear. So the idea is that bones vibrate in there too. But the hearing is really important, and we're going to go through hearing, how you hear in a little bit. Okay. You didn't play with those things in school? No? Oh, yeah, it's wild. Okay. I know this sounds silly, but let's just make sure we do this. So if you did your ears like this for a second, right? Go for it. If you did like this and I talk the same volume, right? You hear me okay? You hear me all right? I'm going to talk the same volume as loud as I can. And you take one hand down, think how much difference it takes. And if I take the other hand down, it really dampens everything, right? Amazing how much your ears pick up from hearing. And if you turn them the other way around like that and I talk the same level, it's really weird. It's some kind of echoing in the back of the room, but it really sounds quite different, you know? So you wonder, why don't we have one ear facing the other direction, one ear in the front, so we could hear who's talking behind your back, right? But the idea is that these ears are really, really helping a lot for you to hear. What else do ears do? What animals can hear really well that you can think of?
Dogs.
Other ones? Isn't it pretty cool that we can do that? What animal can rotate their ears? To kind of hear that fox coming, chasing them.
A rabbit,
exactly, right? Tall ears. So that's pretty cool that they can move their ears around. Not only that, if they get overheated, they get more vascular supply to that, and it actually cools their body off. So it's serving multiple functions, not just for hearing, but also for body cooling. And then you think, oh, you know, when you're in elementary school, everybody will tell you elephants, of course, but elephants not really for the hearing that so much. It's a lot to do with heat regulation as well. So it's pretty cool about the heat regulation. If they get hotter, they get more vascular supply to that, and they can cool off. So that's pretty cool. And they found something just recently about elephants. Anybody ever hear about the stuff about how elephants hear? No, it was found out a few years ago. Really cool studies that they were doing. So the elephants are so heavy, right? They can, when they were in a group and the elephants were far away and they didn't make noises like, you know, whatever they do with their trunk, but they stomped on the ground and the other elephants responded to it that were far away, not visually and not hearing the sound of, you know, the trunk going up and down like in the movies, right? But they actually found out that elephants respond to other elephants the way that they stomp on the ground. So they're feeling the vibrations through the ground. That's pretty cool. And when you think about it, some insects feel that way too. They're like these animals that sit in the sand that wait for vibration around them, and then they pop out of the sand and grab, you know, a prey, for example. Again, like vibrations. But we feel vibrations as well, sound vibrations, when we hear. So it's pretty cool that all this comes together. So you can see, if you really are into the sensory transmission, you have to understand the physics, the sound, the light waves, everything that goes along with us in your perception. And we're not the best at hearing our vision. Smell? What animals can smell really well? Maybe. You might think of dogs, right?
Yes.
What kind of dogs? Who's Bloodhound, German Shepherd, Bloodhound. You bring this up in elementary schools, you're going to have all the kids talking about their dogs and pets. It's a mess. Anyways, so they did some tests, and they actually found out that it wasn't so much bloodhounds, it wasn't the Dobermans that you might think of. It was actually the standard poodles that smelled really well. And so it was a group of, and I should find this paper because I keep forgetting to get the paper. A sheriff's group up in Colorado were trying to find, you know, lost kids that ran away from their campsite or maybe escaped from jail or something. And they wanted to test the different dogs for themselves. And they found out that these poodles were really good. But the sheriff's department said, we're not having a bunch of poodles in our car, you know, macho thing. So they actually use the poodle for tracking and then use the German shepherds for catching whoever it might be if they need to go after somebody. But that was kind of interesting. So the idea is that you don't really know until you do the test. We have a lot of misconceptions about things on smell and taste and things like that. Okay. So we went through receptive fields, and what's interesting too is that you have what's called, and we talked about this a little bit on the vision system before, you have this lateral inhibition. So if you give two stimuli close together, it depends on the system that we're talking about. So this is just the concept right now that we're talking about. If you give two stimuli close together, but one is stronger than the other, it can actually inhibit the neighboring neighboring sensory information. Not so much on your skin, but it happens in your visual field. And we'll cover that in your visual field. I'm just following the textbook here for the concept of lateral inhibition. So you can inhibit signals on the side that aren't as strong, so you'll have better sense for the main stimulus that's coming through. So another concept of lateral inhibition to enhance your sensory reception. Okay, so this is a standard kind of picture that's in a MCAT text kind of thing. And it's interesting about sensory feelings for the Purkinje corpuscles. So you have these inside your skin. They're a little bit deeper in your dermis, but they detect touch, all right? So they detect the vibration. How is it that we transform that that mechanical stimulus into an electrical signal? What's the key word we're looking for? It starts with an S. Stretch activated channels. All right, so stretch activated channels. And there's a whole series of these stretch activated channels. So in that sensory ending right there, this is your sensory ending, this yellow thing right here. There are receptors in there that detect the stretch on the membrane. So when you push on this is like an onion layer. So if you took a pencil and you stab it into an onion, that gives you the concept here. Stab it into that onion, and you pushed on the onion, that mechanical transformation goes down to the sensory ending and opens up stretch-activated ion channels, and you detect that. But let's say that onion has layers that can move around. So now, even though they continually push on it, you no longer get the firing from that neuron anymore. It's no longer depolarized. There's no longer pressure on the stretch-activated ion channels. But you lift that off, and now you feel that change in that movement again on the sensory endings, then opens up the stretch-activated ion channels. So those are referred to as, I'm going to go to this picture ahead of time, if I can find it. No, it's not there. Okay. Wonderful. Where is it? Oh, here. We can go to here. Yeah, this is better. So if you look at that phasic receptor, for example, it's the same kind of analogy on that other side. You detect that initially when you're pushing on it, and you detect it when you push it off, because that receptor accommodates. But what's happening here is that they found out it's not really the neuron that's changing, like I mentioned in the phasic and slow muscle receptor organ or in your muscle spindles, but it's actually the accessory structure around it. It's the onion layers around it. So the accessory structure changed how that sensory neuron is perceiving it. Okay, so I don't want to confuse you on this. It's a little bit different. We talked about this, and the difference between these phasic and tonic was really the ion channel distribution that's in the neuron itself. And they had different types of potassium channels in this one and showed that it could bring that receptor potential back down so it didn't keep firing. That's the neuron having an effect. This is the accessory structure having the effect. So two different ways that this is adapting, if you will, or accommodating to that sensory stimuli. This second way is really the accessory structure on the sensory neuron. So if you take away that onion and you push directly on the sensory ending, which they did, they find out that they continually get the graded potential and it will keep firing. So this shows that accessory structure changes how that sensory neuron perceives the signal. So accessory structures are important. That's the point. Okay. And if we think about hairs, really amazing. Just think about one hair in your hand, on your arm or so, and you can move it back and forth, and you can feel that. It's amazing, right? You know that one hair is moving. So how is it that you perceive that? There's a sensory neuron at the base of that hair that detects it moving back and forth. Insects, so that fly, for example, they detect the wind that's blowing on them, and it's that movement of that hair activating the sensory structure. Now, there's lots of different types of sensory structures and lots of different hairs that do this, but in general, this is one approach. There's actually a sensory ending that's in the shaft of the hair, so when the hair bends one way or the other, it will actually stretch the membrane of that sensory ending, and what's going to be activated? Stretch-activated ion channels, right? And then you get a graded response, and that graded response could continue on. Depends where the site of spike initiation is. Maybe there's a lot of voltage-gated sodium channels here, or maybe they're over here. You know, where are they, right? And that's where then threshold's going to be to fire the action potential that comes on down. We are going to cover a little bit later on in the class and in this chapter, if we ever get through it, that what you've been told, like in 152 and other classes, about always for deep polarization, it's sodium that goes in, right? That's what we hear all the time. Sodium goes in, you activate it, goes through a threshold, and boom, you get an action potential. Not always the case. In lots of hairs of insects, so maybe the majority of the cases, because there's lots of hairs on insects, right? And in ears, we're going to talk about that. It's actually, there's more potassium around the sensory ending, and actually potassium goes in and depolarizes the sensory endings. Is that not wild? So it's kind of a misconception that we always talk about these, just sodium always being the one. But they found out that a lot of cases, these accessory structures around here, see, it's called endolymph. We're going to come back to endolymph later on in the ear. That endolymph is very high in potassium. They call this endolymph because it's like our inner ear. And the potassium actually goes inside the sensory ending through stretch-activated ion channels. And so the potassium that goes in, positive charge, it depolarizes as hell, like sodium. But that means potassium's low on the inside, high on the outside, right? So you see everything you've learned, it's not black and white anymore, right? There's lots of gray areas, there's lots of exceptions, but the principle's the same. Ions moving down their concentration electrochemical gradient, okay? And that can then cause depolarization. And then if there's site of spike initiation somewhere over here where voltage-gated sodium channels open, then you can get an action potential, and that travels to the animal's brain and tells it, oh, something's on that hair that's being stimulated, okay? Other types of hairs have little neurons that wrap around them, for example. Lots of different ways that hairs detect movement. But so there's different ways that this goes on. So here's like just your skin, for example. You can see there's different types of sensory endings, ones for light touch, deep touch, pain, temperature. These Purkinje corpuscles are a little bit deeper in there. Then you got ones that are wrapped around hairs. So actually your skin's pretty complex, right, for touch. Oh, when we were talking about the two-point discrimination, just to remind you, so why is it that, you know, you're so sensitive on your two fingers, right, on your fingertips? Because you have a lot of small receptive fields that overlap, right? Take home with that. So when next time you go in the elevator or somewhere and you see the braille, now you know why that braille is spaced the way it is, because they've actually did the testing to find out most people can then really detect those two points and read the braille quite easily, right? So that there's science behind all that for the braille. That's pretty cool, right? That you have that abilities. So how about somebody that's blind, though, that's walking? And then you sit in with the walking stick, right? And, oh, there's a cable in front of them. Is that walking stick going to hit that cable? No. Right? So what a group, actually, I think it was some high school kids, came up with this, and they were working out, this is many years ago, down in Houston, Texas. And this is before all these, you know, cameras and everything. It was like the beginning of a Go camera that you have on a helmet. They'd have these people walking around with a helmet with a Go camera and actually doing something really cool. They'd wear a backpack on them, like with little toothpicks or pencils, you know, some kind of mechanical information that'd be on their back. So they're walking around with a stick, but then they would have this visual field of that cable, and it would go across their back, and they know where that cable is. And the harder it would push, the closer it is. So they would learn, hey, that cable's about to hit my face, you know, by having that sensory perception on their back. And then they realized, well, the back's not that sensitive, as I told you, right, for two-point discrimination. So then they came up with things they could wear on their arm, on their hand, and now they have things that they can wear on their face because the face is very sensitive to two-point discrimination. So they could have little, like, electrical stimulation, say, oh, it's close by. Oh, it's giving higher stimulation. It's really close by. See how cool that is? So you can come up with these kind of prosthetics, if you will, or ways to detect the environment using other sensory modalities. So great things for helping people with different problems. Okay. So, okay, where are we? Golgi receptors. Let me go back to this muscle picture. So this is pretty cool because we just talked about muscle spindles that are in here that detect proprioception. You have other types of receptors that are at the myotendinous junction. They're not in the tendon, really. They're right in this joint right here, and they detect the force that you pull in that muscle. These are called Golgi tendon organs, so GTOs that you might have heard of in some classes. Golgi tendon organs, right here, Golgi tendon organs. So we talked about muscle spindles and Golgi tendon organs. Golgi tendon organs, people wondered, you know, what are they for, right? But you've probably seen in the movies people picking up heavy weights. They're picking up heavy weights, and then they want to pick it up. They want to pick it up. They're really pushing to pick it up. But all of a sudden, they just have to let go. And it's not that they didn't want to let go, but the sensory system said, this is too much stress for me. So these Golgi tendon organs say, this is too much stretch. I'm going to go fire, and I'm going to inhibit your motor neurons, your alpha motor neurons, and you drop that weight. So it's thought to be a protective mechanism from damaging your myotendinous junctions. Pretty cool. So you can detect the amount of force that you're having to pick up. Not so much for proprioception, though. So that's kind of neat to think about. And not only that, Golgi tendon organs or tension organs were found in crustacean muscles as well. They're in the tendinous region where muscles attach. And if you pull too heavy on it, it actually inhibits the motor neurons too. Wow, all the way down to crustaceans. The same kind of principles holding up. Okay, so let's talk about some other things, and we're going to talk about these along with the other systems that we're going to talk about in a little bit. So this is pretty cool. These are called statoliths, and this analogy we're going to see that also works in our ear. This is a lobster, and at the base of these big antennae, there are little calcium stones in this structure right there. So you see the statocysts. These little stones, calcium carbonate stones, sit on this mucous membrane. It's not the best drawing. Little mucous membrane that then has sensory endings underneath it. So when the animal's crawling down, the gravity pulls those stones downward so it knows it's going down. And if it's crawling up, the stone is pulling back on the back of those sensory structures and so it knows it's going up. What's interesting is people have done work with these, and they know every time the animal molts, sheds its exoskeleton, lays in a new skeleton, these statoliths grow with calcium carbonate. But if they give them magnetic iron at the time of the molting, the magnetic iron gets incorporated in these statocysts. So what did they do? Torture poor little lobsters. They can take a magnet and take the over the magnet, and the lobster thinks it's crawling uphill. Or you pull it down, and it thinks it's going downhill, but it's really not. So it changes its behavior based on that magnetic field, but it's not magnetism it's sensing on that aspect. It's actually activating these statoliths to show that how the animal responds to these. Why was this funded by NASA? You got the idea, the lack of gravity, right? How does the animals respond to the lack of gravity or altered gravity over time? How does the nervous system change? So lots of basic science was done with this to understand the connections in the brain, but also you had to understand the basic physiology of this. And this analogy is the same way that works in our ear as well, as we're going to see for our gravitational sense. Okay, so let's just go. So another aspect just to kind of cover it, and we're going to go through some other systems. You've probably seen on fish, for example, the lateral line on a fish, this line right here that goes on the side of the fish. There are little hairs inside of this. There are like little holes here, and then you see a blown up structure right here. And this little structure has got this kind of gelatin mass that's over it. So when water comes in and moves along here, it's going to deflect this mass one direction or the other so it knows the fluid of water coming across. The structure of that hair cell, you see right here, this one cell here has these little fingers that are coming out of it. So it's called a hair cell. And those fingers are all part of the hair cell, but one of those little fingers is much longer than the other, right? And these are down here. So you see the kinocilium, the long finger on there, compared to shorter fingers. If it moves one direction, it depolarizes. The cell moves the other way, it can kind of inhibit the cell. So it knows the direction of movement of that structure. These hair cells, this kind of structure, wow. You see this over and over again throughout the animal kingdom. It's amazing, and it's the same idea. It picks up fluid movement over these structures and moves the hair cell one way or the other. And this is how we sense hearing, and this is how we sense movement of our head. It's amazing. So we're going to get into that too. But you see that same basic structure used throughout the animal kingdom in different ways for basically perceiving the environment or movement of the animal in their environment. Okay. And we'll talk a little bit more about this when we get into hearing, but there's actually these little links that go between the stereocilia and the kinocilium and up. You can see them right here. So there's a whole group over in the physiology department. Gregory Virchow and Katya, she studies these aspects of hair cells, and they actually study how they work and people with hearing loss and aspects with this. It's really cool. So what they found out, not this group, but people in general, if you lose your hearing, if anybody's ever had a hearing test, right, and you look through the different frequencies, and then you die and you donate your body in, they might then cut up that part of your inner ear. We'll talk about that later. And they can find out that, oh, that region, you've actually lost those little links between these fingers, if you will, the kinocilium and stereocilia, and that's why you've lost your hearing in that region. I mean, they can't do it while you're alive, right? Because you'd lose your hearing. But they've done this even with rats and dogs and cats and all that. And they give them these high-frequency sounds or repetitive sounds for a long period of time, like a jackhammer. And they wonder why people can't hear. People that work like around a jackhammer all the time without hearing, they'll actually lose the hearing in that region because they break these little tracks that go between these to help hold it together. And they found out they don't regenerate. So once those are damaged, that's it. You've lost your hearing. Okay, so it's kind of neat to think about. But these structures are similar throughout. So what happens is you move it one direction, and that actually can depolarize the cell and let calcium in. What do we know about calcium? Well, that can cause vesicles to fuse. And this is how these hair cells then relate to the secondary neurons to then carry that information onto your brain. Okay, and it goes the other direction, and they won't open. So it has to go directionally dependent, all right? And then they release transmitter. Now, people have been studying this for a long time in some particular models like the August Crow principle that we've talked about. Turtles are really good to look at because they can take out these hair cells in their inner ear and actually work with them. And they've done calcium imaging with this. They see the calcium coming in. They see how much transmitter is being released. So it's been really well worked out. But this is a primary structure that's in our ears as well to be able to hear things. So let's just go over this, and this is just for you might want to look over these slides sometimes, but let me get to the inner ear and talk about these different regions, all right? So you, in your ear, right? Let's see if I have a better picture here. No, of course not. Maybe. Okay, I don't, but anyways, I'll send you one. Okay, so air vibration, you hear me talking right now, air vibration goes in, hits what? Tympanic membrane, unless you got a lot of earwax in there, hits the tympanic membrane, moves three little bones, so this is your outer ear, hits the tympanic membrane, there's three little bones there, malleus, inci, stapes, they move, they push on another membrane. And that other membrane is right here, the oval window. And they're going to push on this, and that actually pushes on the fluid that moves inside of this snail-like structure called the cochlea. All right, and that's how you hear. And we're going to talk more about that in a little bit. But that's how you hear. That's why you're hearing me now, okay? So any of these little three little bones that aren't functioning, that's a problem. If you have a stuffed-up head, stuffed-up nose sometimes, your eustachian tube that goes up into this region of the middle ear where those three little bones are, it can get infected and get swollen in there, and then you can't hear well. You know about popping your ears, right, when you take an airplane ride? It's that pressure, it's releasing that pressure for those three little bones so you can hear better. Okay. And then there's actually, they found little muscles on those bones too. That's really amazing. It's kind of the smallest muscles in your body actually that are on those bones. All right, but so here your inner ear now has these semicircular canals, this region here, and a snail-like structure. The snail-like structure is for hearing. It's called the cochlea. These semicircular canals have fluid that's inside of there. Endolymph. Endolymph. Oh, that sounds familiar. Okay, endolymph. This fluid moves around. So when you move your head, you know how you're moving it, right? And you're sideways, and you're going forward, or you're going forward, and you're backwards. And if you're tripped over something that's in the road, and you tripped, and you put forward, guess what? Those things are kicking in pretty quick, and they help you balance yourself, right? So it's pretty amazing that these semicircular canals are pretty good about helping with reflexes as well, or body responses to the change. So think about these canals, and how do they function? Look at the little things that are right here, at the base of these. This is the canal. What does this remind you of? The lateral line in fish, right? So many things sit up the same way. And then you go down to those little hair cells, and they're the same thing that we just talked about. So how is it they detect that fluid movement? So think, and I used to have this device I took to schools, but I lost it somewhere at some school. You take a tube, it was a clear plastic tube, and you put like a feather in it, you glue it to the base, and you have fluid in there. And if you take that tube and you quickly move it one direction, the base of the feather is going to move with the tube, right? But the water pushes down like that. So that's how these detect the movement. Your head moves, and the fluid's going to, you know, it's at rest, but it's moving those hair cells because the fluid is trapped inside that canal. And so the base is moving, and that's how we detect movements. So it's pretty cool how that responds. And then we get into these little regions right here, the utriculus and sacculus, or saccula and utricula. And I'll blow it up right here. These structures aren't shown really well here, but these are no different than these things right here that I'm talking about right here. These like little otoliths, these little stones that are sitting on here. What does that remind you of? These little stones right here, right? And the lobster, the statocyst. So the utriculus in sacculus have these little stones that are on there like this, and they move with gravity, or they're gonna sense the gravity, no different than the lobster statocyst. So when you move your head forward and you step still, those little stones are moving a different direction, and they're pulling down, and it tells you your head's forward, right? You can close your eyes and you know your head's backwards, or you know your head's sideways. I'm not moving the semicircular canals now. I'm moving the statocyst, basically is these utriculus and sacculus. So sometimes people that have a head injury, we had a basketball player 1 year. She was on a freshman team. She was a freshman. And she actually, in practice, fell and hit her head really hard. And then she couldn't function well. She had dizzy spells. She couldn't tell where she was. It was like vertigo all the time, right? And think about it. You can't read. You can't do anything. You're sick. You're feeling motion sickness. They give medications. What do they do for a person like this? They got to lay on one side. Well, they try to figure out where the problem is and try to let that heal. So they had to lay on one side for, like, you know, basically all the time they could. And about 6 months later, she started to get back feeling again and begin to have perception. But if they don't, they try to do surgery. There's a lot of weird things about that. So just imagine if you had a head injury, hit your head really, and you tore those kind of off of that, then you're going to have vertigo and you're going to have real problems. Other times with head injuries, if you hit real hard, like on an icy day, like happened to me that first ice storm we had, and boop, flip, boom, crack. I heard it crack. That's why I'm crazy, probably. And I was wondering what happened. But, you know, and you worry about all these little things that go on, traumatic brain injury and all that. But you worry about if you cracked your skull, that endolymph that's right there, this is inside of there, right? You can crack your skull, and that fluid can leak out. If that fluid leaks out on one side, you have problems. You're not going to be able to tell how your body is in position. You don't know if you're moving or not moving. The fluid's off. You lose your equilibrium, but you also can lose your hearing just by the endolymph cracking and being leaking out in a cracked skull, for example, right behind your ear. So this is kind of interesting to think about. So that's the problem with the statocyst and the utriculus that are in there for static position. Okay, static position. The semicircular canals for dynamic movements, all right? test questions, all right? And now we see that these nerves come out of here. This is a vestibular nerve for vestibular function. It goes to the part of your brain that detects these movements. And then you have the auditory nerve, and they form then this vestibular auditory nerve to your brain. Okay. Woo. So we went through all that. We will get to the here is this picture I was looking for. So here's your tympanic membrane, Malasinski stapes. We will talk about the cochlear region next time on Tuesday. We do have class lectures next week, even though you have exams. We do have lectures, okay? But you don't have a lab, you know, activity. You have an exam. We will pick up with the cochleus hearing later. Okay. So migrate. You want to flip through it really fast and look at all the questions and then start to think about it. There's there's extra questions on there, bonus questions, right? Basically, try not to leave anything blank. Oh, you need pencil up there. Pencils, going across. You're drawing a blank on one question, just go to the next one, and then it'll come to you for the other one. You still have time. There's no hurry.
We can keep the other class at bay for a little bit if you need to.